Good morning and welcome. It's Saturday morning, time for Final Draft. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. My name's Andrew Popel, and every Saturday morning, Final Draft is a half hour of books, writing, and literary culture. And every month, last weekend of the month, we do a special Classics Book Club. This week on the book club, we are looking back to David Ballantyne's Sydney Bridge Upside Down. This book floored me. It is so deceptive and just really unveils itself. I absolutely loved it. I'm very excited to be talking to you about it. And joining me in the book club this week, I'll be speaking with Jane Pearson. She is a senior editor at Text Publishing. Text are, of course, the wonderful people who bring us the classics that we discuss every month. Joining us also in the book club is Kate de Goldie. Kate is a New Zealand author of novels, short fiction, and children's books. She also wrote the introduction to the Text Classic edition of Sydney Bridge Upside Down. So you are on the Classics Book Club this week on Final Draft. Always exciting to discover and rediscover these amazing books. That conversation is coming up right after the break on 2SER 107.3.
Want a look into the newsrooms of the future? Storyology is the Walkley Foundation's Festival of Journalism and Storytelling. This year, we're bringing you top journalists from Facebook and Google, as well as leading media innovators from 18 cities in 8 countries around the world. Visit walkleys.com and use the offer code STUDENT to get 20% off full Storyology passes. Storyology sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel, and it is time once again for the Australian Classics Book Club. Once a month, we visit an amazing work of fiction, discover it, rediscover it, and unpack what it means. And joining me today, I have Jane Pearson. Jane is a senior editor at Text Publishing, who are the wonderful people who publish the classics that we discuss on Final Draft. Jane, welcome to the book club.
Thank you, Andrew.
And I also have Kate de Goldie. Kate is a New Zealand author of novels, short fiction and books for children. She has a slew of awards for her work and has written the introduction to the Text Classic edition of today's book, Sydney Bridge Upside Down, by David Ballantyne. Welcome, Kate.
Hello, nice to be here.
And look, Kate, I think we should probably clear this up from the outset. While I've been calling this the Aussie Classics Book Club until now, today's text, Sydney Bridge Upside Down by David Ballantyne, is in fact a New Zealand classic. It would be terribly unfair of us to try and steal this masterpiece of writing and only give you Barnaby Joyce in return.
Well said. I'm very happy that this book has been brought back to life by Australians. So it's kind of between the two of us now.
But before we get really deep into the text, I want to find out a little bit about David Ballantyne. Jane, can you tell us who David Ballantyne was and a little bit about his life of work?
Yes, well, as you note, Andrew, he was a New Zealander. He was born in 1924. And when he was quite a young child, his family moved to a very remote town in the North Island called Hicks Bay. And he spent quite a bit of his childhood there. And it's generally accepted and agreed that this is where our book of today was set. He wrote his first novel at the age of 23. That's called The Cunninghams, which is a marvellous novel. It was published in the US and received a lot of attention there, but not so much in this part of the world. And it wasn't until he was 44 that he wrote Sydney Bridge Upside Down, so quite a time later. He had been a cadet reporter at the Auckland Star since he was about 15, so writing had been his life forever, and I think he'd even published some his own little magazine before then. He wrote voraciously, from what I gather, and I noted a lovely little anecdote in his biography by Brian Reid about how when they were all living as young men in a shared house having lots of parties, there'd be times where David would have his typewriter out and, oblivious to everything going on around him, would be thrashing out whatever piece of fiction he was working on at the time. He very sadly became an alcoholic for a while and wrote a couple more novels after Sydney Bridge Upside Down, never quite getting the success that we all now know he deserved. And then very sadly died in his 60s in 1986. A brilliant writer.
And we have this brilliant work, Sydney Bridge Upside Down, and just a brief outline, it tells the tale across a summer, a perhaps seemingly innocent summer, told from the perspective of Harry Baird, of the events that we soon realise are dotted and fraught with tragedy. And there is so much going on in this book. I feel like if we're going to talk about Sydney Bridge Upside Down, we need to throw away the idea that we can avoid spoilers completely. Because this book, it's this really slow unravelling. And the way I found it was that crucial events sort of reveal themselves, or are at least hinted at, very early on. And then we have the process of reading where we're confirming and revealing and then just really coming to face the horror that all of this could be true. I mean, I don't want to reveal everything, but do you think that's fair? This part of this is just this amazing way David Ballantyne drips us information through his narrator, Harry.
Yeah, in many respects, there's things that are very familiar about this story. It's sort of touching on a gothic tradition, thriller tradition, innocent child viewing human misbehaviour with great puzzlement. But I think it's actually this sort of mode of telling the story that makes it the great novel, because Ballantyne begins it in a most beguiling way with the sort of tones of classic storytelling. You know, the opening paragraph feels sort of gentle and like we're about to be ushered into a summer holiday, but then he withholds constantly throughout, and we have an unreliable narrator, and we're constantly having to sort of assess our uneasy feelings about the narrator and whether what he's telling us can be relied on.
Yes, he's certainly an unreliable narrator, and he... not through any deliberate trope a lot of the time, but I think he's so unsure about the world around him and what he, on that sort of cusp between innocence and experience, is feeling is this sort of fear and uncertainty and finding the world a sinister kind of place. And David Ballantyne, it seems, is surrounding him with that sinister feeling, not only in his movement through into a world of experience, but in the setting itself, which is on one level idyllic, but also really quite unsettling and disturbing. There's the meatworks that are closed and partially falling down and really dangerous and yet exciting somehow. There's the old man and his horse that pick up the goods from the ship that visits every once in a while. The horse is called Sydney Bridge Upside Down, by the way, which is where the title comes from. And the horse is even a little decrepit. It's got a very sway back, hence its name. And Sam Phelps himself has a scar. There's a scar on his face that's mysterious and a little bit disturbing. There's just all of these things around in this environment that are sort of swirling around in a slightly worrying way.
I want to pick up on what you've both said there about Harry being an unreliable narrator, because I very early on in my notes wrote that down. And then I was constantly confronted by the way Ballantyne structures the text into thinking that I was actually a really unreliable reader. At one point,
yes.
I went right back to the very beginning, where there's this scene at the beginning where I thought something really horrible had happened, where I think it's Harry and Dibbs are fighting, and and Dibbs goes over. So the way Harry talks about it, Dibbs goes over the cliff, and I'm like, why are we not talking about this for pages and pages? And I was like, what happened? And then Dibs is just sort of there, and I'm like, I've missed something. And Ballantyne structures it in this way that really just confounded me.
And he deflects from the sort of basic theme and the main intent all the time. I mean, I think that bit is a classic piece of deflection. He actually wants you destabilized as you read and to question everything that you're reading.
Kate, I was really interested in, from your introduction to the Text Classics edition, you talk about a thesis from Dr. Patrick Evans that New Zealand literature began in, I think it was 1882, with the introduction of refrigerated shipping. And yes. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that and elaborate on how that impacts on a tale like Sydney Bridge Upside Down.
Well, that thesis of slaughterhouse fiction was the centrepiece of Patrick Evans's New Zealand literature course that I attended during the 1980s. And he wrote a number of very influential and penetrating essays about this very subject. So his first class would begin, New Zealand literature began in 1882 or 86, whatever it was. And he would then, basically he talked about the country's economy being entirely dependent on the slaughter of animals, pastoral and dairy. And this is what's at the base of New Zealand society. And it's a kind of constant carnage that sort of bubbles up in the literature but isn't really talked about anywhere else. So there's several examples of slaughterhouse fiction. But for him, Ballantyne was the preeminent novelist in terms of this theme. And The Cunninghams has, it's about a lot of things. It's a Between the Wars novel, but it has a number of quite, just really moody and unsettling images of big farming trucks taking sheep to the slaughterhouse and sheep lined up outside the slaughterhouse. So he's making very deliberate comparisons between vulnerable animals, children, and other vulnerable adults. And it's sort of apotheosis in Sydney Bridge Upside Down because the meat economy has retreated from Hicks Bay, but the slaughterhouse is left there. And what happens in the slaughterhouse now, the empty slaughterhouse, is a matter of great disturbance for Harry.
There's also those moments where he is really intensely kind of tumbling out feelings about you're not even quite sure what, but there's the groans of the animals, the sort of history of the place coming through in this kind of horror of slaughter. It's really very powerful in the novel.
And it's a place, I mean, they're not allowed to go there, but they go there constantly. They've been forbidden to play there. So it's just hung about with danger, even as it's empty. And when Harry finally glimpses, I won't say who they are, a couple having sex there, the comparison is unavoidable that the sounds and the actions they make are analogous to animals being slaughtered. Mm.
This is the New Zealand Classics Book Club on Final Draft. We're discussing David Ballantyne's Sydney Bridge Upside Down. I am joined by Jane Pearson and Kate DeGoldie. And if you want to find out a little bit more about the mystery of Sydney Bridge Upside Down, that is coming up, but we're going to take a track right now. This is from Japanese Breakfast, and it's called Roadhead. You're tuned into 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. I'm Andrew Popel. The track we just heard was Roadhead from Japanese Breakfast, and we're in the New Zealand Classics Book Club. Once a month, we do visit a classic work of fiction, and today we've got David Ballantyne's Sydney Bridge Upside Down. I'm joined by Jane Pearson and Kate DeGoldie, and we're looking at the darker themes of the book. Sydney Bridge Upside Down almost defies genre. I mean, we're tempted to almost go into that sort of YA or younger type realm with Harry being this young narrator talking about the summer. I mean, you could almost imagine it unfolding in a kind of boy's own sort of way. But then I thought, is this in fact a horror story? I couldn't shake the feeling there are two deaths throughout Sydney Bridge Upside Down, and that as they're revealed that we're in fact perhaps witnessing that sort of slasher-style horror story with the killer slowly stalking the victim. You know, that sort of shaky cam point of view. And of course, we learn this is actually what's happening. It's just that there's not this supernatural beast of the film trope.
I mean, I think horror is the right term to some degree, because you float somehow close to things being immaterial, not quite of the world, and which I assume is partly Harry's fevered evocation of it. But I mean, I think you're right, it is unpindownable, and I think it's far better than most young adult novels, but it has, as you say, the younger narrator navigating the adult world. But he is still a prepubescent child, or at least on the cusp, which I think is important, because he then becomes one of those children in fiction, in literary fiction, who sees, knows, but deliberately misunderstands or suppresses in order to survive.
And it's, I think, part of the brilliance of this novel is this wonderful bringing together of that child's voice and a certain level a naivety in it with a really dark and quite deep sort of horror angle that appear kind of not to fit together and yet somehow are so wonderfully entwined. It really is all the more chilling for that too.
And you know, it's not just Harry being the unreliable narrator and one feeling kind of unseated by the different things you discover. All around him, everything through his view has become sinister and threatening. And the person I find the most sinister is Susan Prosser next door, because she's like some kind of snout, I guess. I mean, she spies on Harry and he finds her a threat, but it's the very sort of blank-faced way she talks to him. You feel she can kind of undo him at any moment, but that's another grand piece of deflection.
Well, that is certainly the way he sees her, but I think she's very much like him in that she is constantly aware of having to play people because she doesn't quite understand them or something. And I think that might be partly why he's so unsettled by her, is that he knows he can read her because she's like him, whereas he seems to have so much trouble reading almost everybody else.
An aspect of the horror movie genre is the mask and who is the real killer. I mean, even in sort of the old slasher films like Friday the 13th, learning about the killer becomes very, getting behind the mask becomes so very important. And as Harry looks around his town, we see him kind of trying to get behind masks, from Susan Prosser's spying on him to that really obvious mask that Wiggins wears with the big bushy beard. He's constantly trying to get behind masks, and he feels like everyone is wearing them. And then we have this really, I found, sort of interesting situation of this nascent emerging sexuality when Carolyn arrives, and Harry himself reflects later on in the text that he doesn't recognize himself from even a month or two before. When Carolyn arrived, he's changed so much.
And that he's experienced the fall, hasn't he? Because he's been introduced to sexuality and he's absolutely enchanted by it, but fearful of it at the same time.
It's really interesting too. He's aware that there's something going on, but he really doesn't understand it. There's this wonderful moment where he's really worried about the men in the town and their reactions to Carolyn and her responses to that, And he's most worried about the butcher, Wiggins, who says things that Harry doesn't really understand. They seem just banal comments to him that make Carolyn smile. And at one point he asks her why she smiles. And even her answer, which is, it's the way he said it, Harry doesn't understand, but he comes up with this beautiful explanation that it must be hypnosis, because it's beyond his imagination to understand the sexual communication between them, and yet he feels it, he senses it so strongly.
I think Carolyn's smile is probably one of the most obvious masks in the book, but it's the one that Harry has so much trouble seeing through. I mean, sexuality for him in the book is almost entirely destructive and confounding. If we look at the experience of his mother and the way that narrative plays out, the way that he sees it threatening Caroline, particularly at the hands of Wiggins, but he can't shy away from it when it's the time that he spends with Carolyn. And it's kind of some really shocking scenes. They have this game that they play each morning where they run naked up and down the halls, and then there are times when he lays on her chest and she's like sort of topless in her room. And
I think women for Harry generally are puzzling. I mean, he feels really ambivalent about his mother. She's gone, so he misses her, but he's angry with her. And matters with Carolyn can turn on a dime as well. I think the interesting woman in the story, who's much less ambiguous than the others, is Mrs. Kelly. Mm. And he tends to like to be near her because there's some kind of reconstruction of happy family around him.
Mm. Well, his own sense of his own mother has been so devastatingly undermined, and I suppose she is she could almost be a replacement for him.
And I would love to think for a second then about storytelling, because Harry is telling us this story. That's what makes it so difficult, because we can only see what he sees. But storytelling figures really heavily in the book. Carolyn is writing what she calls her autobiography throughout, which seems like something of an affectation of a diary. We have Susan Pross's letter that she is threatening to send to Harry's mother, which he believes is going to chronicle something that he feels perhaps will either be misunderstood or that he should be guilty about. And then we have Harry's storytelling, and particularly skirting around the spoilers here, his storytelling at the end in this really strange chapter 13 where he's relating a version of his life in this fantastical sort of fairy tale way. Storytelling is so important, but so unreliable here.
I mean, that's a sort of secondary or maybe even a primary theme, isn't it? Mm. I mean, it's a kind of meta notion, and Ballantyne does that all the way through his career, play with the plausibility, reliability, and virtue of, you know, dubious virtue of fiction.
I loved, there was a quote that I had to write down, and it maybe has a dark cast on it with what we're currently talking about, but it's when the new teacher arrives in Calliope Bay and they're talking about the packing cases, and Mrs. Kelly remarks, it's the books that take the room and make the weight, which I thought was hilarious because I moved sort of less than 12 months ago, and I actually had to move all my boxes of books myself because the removalist refused to take them down the stairs because they were too heavy. And now I just wonder about the weight of the story.
Yeah. Absolutely. And do you know, Ballantyne conceived Sidney Britch as part of a trilogy.
Oh.
And I can't remember whether that's second or maybe it's the first story. And that final chapter, which I always think is like a kind of really discordant film imagery mashup, hints at what comes between the end of the book and that final chapter.
My mind has just been blown.
2SER.com.
You are on 2SER 107.3. It's Final Draft, and you're in the usually Australian Classics Book Club. This month it is the New Zealand Classics Book Club. I have been discussing David Ballantyne's Sydney Bridge Upside Down with Jane Pearson, senior editor at Text Publishing, and author of novels, short fiction and books for children, Kate DeGoldie. Look, if you have missed anything, 2SER.com is the place to go. You can listen back to this episode and many more. It's almost the end of the show. Big thank you again to Kate and to Jane. Really appreciate them getting together. I love discussing classic fiction. I love discovering it and rediscovering it. Now, The Vulture's Nest is up next. To get us there, I've got a track. It's from Carolyn Says. It's a debut album, probably my favourite album name for a very long time. 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong. And this is a really beautiful, almost haunting track. From Carolyn Says, this is I Think I'm Alone Now. You've been listening to Final Draft. I'm Andrew Popel. I'll see you next week for more books. Bye now.